Okay, we're recording. So where did we end last week? We finished. Did we do this? I know we did the war diff men difference between men and women. We did get into the CAD and CHD. Yes, we did that. Okay. I did talk about this atherosclerosis, this growth of plaque and narrowing of arteries can affect any arteries in brain or heart or organs. And yes, you can get occluded vessels in the mesentery of the gut, and parts of the colon will die accordingly. It's not overly common, but it's not unusual for sure. When the heart's referred to as a coronary artery disease or coronary heart disease, in the brain it's known as cerebrovascular disease. So you'll see CVA is a term that's used medically when we're looking at a stroke, if you ever come across that term. I told you about the Framingham Heart Study that is still ongoing since 48, and within this questionnaire they do, because they follow people through their entire lifespan, asking questions in the survey, and this is how they come up with many of the risk factors that we have now for heart disease, about smoking and sedentary lifestyle and so forth. It's still known that blood lipid levels, diabetes, systolic blood pressure, and cigarette smoking are independent predictors of risk. And it seems that African American and Mexican American women have a greater risk for CVD. And that's usually within postmenopausal environment, more so, again, because of those cardioprotective mechanisms of estrogen. Cigarette smoking is the leading preventable cause of coronary artery disease. And elevated total serum cholesterol levels does place you at a greater risk for heart disease. And this is has to do with HDLs and LDLs. So we want lots of HDLs. We don't want high levels of LDLs. LDLs meaning low, right? Low density lipoproteins, and HDLs meaning high density lipoproteins. So there are good fats and there are not good fats. Hypertension, of course. Hypertension is a big risk factor and needs to be controlled. It's one of those things. Have you guys found in clinic? Have you found many people with hypertension in clinic yet? Come across patients? You guys are treating patients now, right? Okay. Physical inactivity, of course. They're now saying that being physically inactive is as dangerous as smoking cigarettes in terms of cardiovascular disease. So we need to be getting people moving. Insulin resistance, hyperinsulinemia, glucose intolerance. Again, they seem to promote these plaques and this narrowing of blood vessels. And of course, in the menopausal and postmenopausal woman, it's now known that postmenopausal is likely a contributing risk factor because of the lack of estrogen after menopause. Depression, another again, is a factor for it, and other mental health issues. Alcohol consumption. Again, they say moderation is the key, but it is alcohol consumption is amongst the top 10 risk factors for coronary artery disease. Older than 40 is more likely to be symptomatic, and one or more members of the immediate family with the disease is associated with an increased risk of coronary artery disease. When I worked in the hospital, one of the major questions that I would always get asked, do you have a first degree relative who's had a heart attack? That's the first question, yes or no, and if they say yes, then they ask the age of that individual when they had their heart attack. And if it's under the age of 50, that's considered an extremely high risk factor for the potential for the individual having a genetic predisposition to that sort of thing. New predictors. So it's possibly identified markers for CAD in apparently healthy individuals in blood. So homocysteine is an amino acid that's generated as the body metabolizes methionine, and high levels of homocysteine is present in people with CAD. I don't think they know exactly why yet, but they just seem to see it. So what they're attempting to do is to find markers where they can, even more earlier than we could in previous, be able to do some blood work on an individual and see that there's a potential for coronary artery disease with some of these markers. C-reactive proteins reflects low-grade inflammation and seems to predict hypertension, diabetes, and heart attacks and strokes before they occur. Lipoproteins slow the breakdown of blood clots. Lipoprotein A, blood pressure less than 60, measure of arterial stiffness. So that's did you guys talk about that much when you did blood pressure testing in theory? But what does blood pressure really represent in terms of thinking about it from a cardiovascular perspective? We take blood pressure, we learn the numbers 120, 40, and sorry, or 120 over 80, sorry, and then getting up to 140 over 90 or borderline hypertensive, and we know those numbers, right? And we are considered to them. But do you ever have an understanding of what might be going on in the body if a person has got an idiopathic hypertension, which most of them are? It can represent atherosclerotic changes. The reason why the pressure goes up is because the blood vessels are no longer elastic; they're hardened, and they can't react to the vasodilation. And therefore, the narrower the vessel, the higher the resistance. So, if vessels are unable to dilate because they have atherosclerotic changes, then they stay narrow, which increases resistance, which then goes all the way back to the heart's ability to eject blood, and it's meeting against a greater resistance. Therefore, it reacts by contracting harder, and therefore you see it in an increase in your, which one, systolic or diastolic? Well, both, but initially first it's working harder, and then the overall, right? We talk much about the numbers when you add, you take the diastolic and systolic. Yeah, did we talk much about that? We really didn't, did we? It sort of expresses what kind of existing pressure there is in the system. If you take your diastolic and minus it by your systolic.
The pulse pressure?
Yeah, well, the pulse pressure is the one, right, when you subtract one from the other. And it can represent atherosclerotic changes if that larger that number gets, okay? Erectile dysfunction, as I said, is now considered to be another marker for cardiovascular disease. And, of course, metabolic syndrome, so cluster of conditions that occur together, increasing your risk of heart disease, stroke, and type 2 diabetes. So sometimes, you'll see individuals have blood work done and be leading an extremely healthy lifestyle, but their triglyceride or cholesterol levels are through the roof. They have what's called hyperlipidemia, and it's a genetic metabolic condition where they just happen to produce a lot of it. So, do we do this? Are atherosclerosis? No, I don't think we did this slide. So, atherosclerosis plays a key role in the restriction of blood flow through the coronary circulation. So, it's changes that are occurring in the vessels that really affects blood flow. In this case, we'll talk about the heart. It is now accepted that this atherosclerotic change is a chronic inflammatory condition triggered by low-density lipoprotein depositions and immune activation on the interior wall. When I worked at the hospital in cardiorespiratory, this was thought to be, but it hadn't been proven yet. We now know that people who have heart attacks, is likely there's been changes in the arterial wall and there's an inflammatory response, which has led to this problem. Well, we have to remember, we have these endothelial cells, right? This tunica intima that lines blood vessels. And it does play that role, as I said, it keeps things smooth, allows blood to flow through quite nicely. And the other thing it does, it produces chemicals that relaxes the smooth muscle in the tunica media, and also it tends to have some anticoagulant mediators that help prevent clotting. Now, in the environment of hypertension, dyslipidemia, insulin resistance, this endothelial lining can become dysfunctional, which means, therefore, it doesn't relax the muscle layer, and it doesn't provide things that prevent clotting. So we say the dysfunction leads to vascular wall events, including inflammation, thrombogenesis. Thrombogenesis is the creation of a thrombus, vasoconstriction, and oxidative stress. When we get these, you have to understand, when we look at inflammation as it sets up, there are mediators that stimulate an inflammatory response, right? And remember, inflammation is good because we can't have healing without inflammation. It can't occur. But this is when it starts to get a little bit damaging, shall we say. So these mediators get produced, and it triggers within that area inflammation that comes in and actually damages this endothelial lining, which then leads to further inflammation, and you get into this really bad cycle. Where we have this damage occur, these low-density lipoproteins, which are running in the blood at any given time along with HDLs, they're kind of doing their thing. When we have this damage, we get these LDLs that infiltrate this damaged area. So we have to remember when we think about the anatomy of vessels, so we have our tunica adventitia, and we have our thicker tunica media, and then of course we have this endothelial lining on the bottom here. Tunica media or intima. So we're saying here that what happens is you get some of these things occurring and you get these pro-inflammatory mediators, and then you start to break down parts of this lining, and they just aren't functioning appropriately. What happens then, you start to get LDL, it starts building up in here, starts collecting in these damaged sites because of this this breakdown. So at the damaged site, LDL in the blood infiltrates and starts to build up this plaque within the intima. So even though there's damage to the intima, which allowed it in the first place, the other thing that starts happening is the intima starts to build an intima covering over top of it, and which allows some protection, shall we say, to occur, right? So we've got these red blood cells that are going to travel through, right? They're rolling along here. And remember I said, when it comes to clotting influence, one of the things we need is a very smooth surface so that when the blood slides along, it's not getting irritated and it won't stimulate to a clot. So when we have the plaque building, the intima will create a layer over top of this building plaque to keep it smooth as a reaction so that the blood cells don't move into a situation where they're starting to go into a clot. So when we have this, the LDL goes into the damaged site and builds up this plaque within the intima. If that building of the plaque further stimulates more inflammation, and all of a sudden you get this cell adhesion molecules that start coming together. These inflammatory and immune cells stick to the lesion and amplify the inflammatory response by producing more inflammatory mediators, leading to more wall damage and more LDL deposition. So in other words, through this whole cycle of damage, LDL, inflammatory markers, you get more inflammation, you get the cells getting stuck together, which stimulates more inflammation, which stimulates more inflammatory response, which stimulates more LDL types of fats. And what happens eventually, of course, then can get to a point where you can have, I'm just going to put the other intima layer here. You get to a point where eventually you're starting to get this. And it just keeps growing and growing and growing. Now what's happened to the diameter of this vessel? It's now only this thick here, isn't it? So now you've got a potential for a blood clot to get produced, and that blood clot, because it's such a small area, can actually jam into that narrow area, and then all of a sudden, on this side of the vessel, there's no blood moving forward. So whatever tissues this end is supplying will then die, or at least be ischemic initially and have a problem. So we say that inflammatory and immune cells stick to the lesion, amplify the inflammatory response by producing more mediators. This leads to more wall damage and more LDL deposition of these low-density lipoproteins. Punctate, studded or denoting dots or tiny holes, calcium deposits are also found in this plaque, which destabilizes the lesion and makes the vessel stiffer. So chronic inflammation creates can create calcium, right? You guys, you haven't done muscular pathology yet, have you? With ossificans, myositis ossificans yet? So chronic inflammation of muscle can actually have deposits of calcium in it. Same thing happens here. You can actually get to the point where you start getting calcium deposition in here, and then that calcium, of course, being the nature of what calcium is, it hardens the vessel wall, and it not only does it stay narrow, it can't dilate, so that space never gets any larger. So we can see it here, and in the drawings you can see that it's on both sides. You can see just how narrow it can get, and you can see how red blood cells then get bottlenecked and can't travel along. And you can get some moving along. I like this picture because it kind of represents a condition called angina. So what happens is when the heart's at resting, say for example, even though that's narrowed, enough red blood cells might get through to feed the muscular wall of the heart, and the patient doesn't express any problems at all. But when exercise happens or stress on the heart where the heart rate has to go up and the myocardium demands more oxygen, you can see where the red blood cells bottleneck, and now the muscle starts screaming, saying, "I'm not getting enough oxygen," because red blood cells actually aren't getting there. So as the plaque develops, it's covered by a fibrous cap made of collagen. The cap is covered by a layer of endothelial cells, which stay intact until the later stages of atherosclerosis. So we get this growth that's occurring, we get a bit of a cap on it, and as I said, the endothelial lining will line it to try to maintain that smooth sort of environment the blood likes. The cap protects the plaque contents from contacting blood, thus preventing clotting. So the clot itself, shall we say, is rough, and if it gets exposed, the red blood cells will bump up against it and then bump against each other, and then all of a sudden you'll start to get clot formation. When the cap breaks down, the atherosclerotic plaque ruptures, exposing its thrombogenic surface. In other words, by exposing the plaque itself, again, it's an environment the red blood cells don't like, and they will then react by forming a thrombus that occludes or blocks the lumen or the inside of the vessel, preventing blood from moving along. So a thrombus is what? Right. What's the difference between a thrombus and an embolism? Well, and the thrombus stays right where it is. Still a blood clot. It's not a blood clot like you think of when you scratch yourself and get that crusty kind of thing on top. It's gelatinous in nature. It's thick. It's red blood cells. They're all stuck together into this pudding kind of consistency. Because if you remove the clot, it's a term we use in English is blubbery, kind of jiggly, gelatinous type of thing. Okay? The obstruction, of course, of the blood flow develops not due to the gradual narrowing of the lumen, but to the rupture or erosion of that plaque, precipitating a thrombus formation that obstructs the lumen, leading to the MI. So when we look at heart attacks, for example, you might have someone, and as this plaque builds, the majority of the time the patient is not symptomatic. The patient has no idea this is happening. And if you remember, I talked about in one of the earlier slides, quite often the first time a patient knows that they have heart disease is when they have that first cardiac event. And prior to that, they will swear they felt nothing. Now, occasionally patients will say, like that happened here for me a few years ago, one of the fellows I used to work with, he was walking up the stairs. He was a 40-something, and he just walked up 15 stairs, and he was sweating, he was diaphoretic, and he was breathing hard. And I'm like, Rob, and he's very overweight. Like, you've got to lose weight. And sure enough, 6 months later, he had a massive heart attack. Because, again, he was demanding of his heart when he was walking up the stairs, and there was enough occlusion that he was starting to feel effects of it. And he's a paramedic. And he ignored it. Even small atherosclerotic plaques can rupture and cause problems. So you have to think of tiny, tiny vessels in the brain have the same thing. This is one thing I talk to patients about is if you've got a blocked artery in your heart, you've likely got semi-blocked arteries very many other places in your body. This is why gentlemen tend to have erectile dysfunction, because again, the blood vessels that feed the penis, there has plugged as these cardiac vessels, and times when an erection is required, the blood can't get there because there's occlusion that's occurring. So that's why it's considered a bit of a risk factor. So we can see here in this pathological cross section, here is the lumen of the artery. This is the plaque. You can see how much it has invaded the entire diameter of that blood vessel. You can see it here as well. So here's your plaque ruptured here. So you've had this endothelial lining covering it. You can see there within the plaque, there are microvessels that can happen and get further blood that's leaking into this. And then you start to get this plaque starts sticking out. And then you get this whole inflammatory response, and then you get this clotting mechanism, and then you end up with a thrombus. Atherosclerosis by itself does not necessarily produce symptoms. There needs to be critical deficit of blood supply, thus oxygen to the heart or other structures supplied by the blood vessel. Again, atherosclerosis doesn't necessarily have any symptomology at all. It's not until that there's diminished supply to whatever vessel or muscle we're talking about that the patient then says, oh, I have pain or I have discomfort, I feel short of breath, whatever it might be. When atherosclerosis develops slowly, collateral circulation develops to meet the heart's needs. So that's the one thing that's very interesting about the heart itself. If we just kind of, actually, I'm going to do it in red because we use those. Okay, so on the outside, of course, we know that we have, you know, we've got a circular blood vessel here that kind of goes around like so. We have another one that travels down here. And then, of course, we have all these branches accordingly that are feeding the myocardium. So if we have the building of a plaque here at this point that is, you know, taking its time, the heart will actually, through angiogenesis, create a collateral branch. Actually, I've got it on the wrong side. Yeah, I got it on the right side. So that if this did actually form a thrombus and completely occlude, normally this whole area here would be affected of the heart muscle because there's no blood. But because previously a collateral branch was created, we don't get the same kind of damage. Now, my experience was in talking to internal medicine guys and gals, now, this is why young people die quite easily of heart attacks compared to older people, because they haven't built the collateral circulation that a person who's maybe 60-something does. Exercise also produces collateral circulation, so therefore they tend to have other alterations in vessel placement. And quite often people who spend, you know, years doing high-level activities, they might have a heart attack, but they won't do as much damage because they've got all this collateral circulation. Common sequelae of atherosclerosis affecting coronary arteries include angina, myocardial infarction or heart attack, and then sudden death. Men experience angina as the first symptom of coronary artery disease in 1/3 of all cases, and heart attack or sudden death in the majority. So two-thirds of people who get their first symptom that there's something going wrong in their heart is either heart attack or sudden death. The lesser amount start with a little bit of pain and discomfort that brings them to the doctor. I've got this bad indigestion and I feel short of breath, those sort of things. Half of all women experience angina while the other half remain asymptomatic. So how do we prevent? Cardiovascular disease and coronary artery disease are largely preventable. Therefore, prevention is the goal, which are lifestyle changes. So again, we know smoking cigarettes, having hypertension, being a diabetic with uncontrolled sugars, all those sorts of things, those are things we can alter and change to prevent someone from running into this kind of problem. So that's what our goal is. Atherosclerosis is not a disease of middle age to old age. It actually begins in adolescence and young. Now, I took a course many years ago with a gerontologist, and we were talking about heart disease. And don't quote me on this, and maybe Sunil, you know, but they find fatty streaks in coronary arteries in six-month-olds. We start laying fats down into coronary arteries at that age. I think it is a bit of a natural progression, but that then through lifestyle we speed it up or make it more aggressive. So the fact that, you know, a 65-year-old has atherosclerotic changes is not because of their lifestyle now. It's because they spent a whole lifetime from a very, very young age that's resulted in this problem from happening. So it's a very slow progressing type of disease. So it's something to think about, is that if someone does, you know, a relative or whatever does have a heart attack, that's something that's been ongoing for a very, very long time prior to the actual heart attack. Controlling LDL-C before atherosclerosis gets a chance to do much damage, we can do that through diet, exercise, drugs called statins or other cholesterol-lowering medications. And that's a conversation we had years ago, why we don't put everybody on a statin, especially men and postmenopausal women. Just a really low amount. Diagnosis. National guidelines advise everyone older than 20 have his or her cholesterol checked to establish a baseline with a follow-up every 5 years. So should be happening. And then we can do a coronary angiograph, which is basically, it's an X-ray examination with the use of a dye, so the injected dye, and it will follow through the blood vessels and they can see if there's any changes there. But anything I've read said there is limitations in it. They've, you know, many patients have actually had these angiograms. Things look pretty good, but they still have a heart attack, and kind of surprised those who were doing the test. Echocardiography is another one. Ultrasound imaging of the heart, so they actually do that. And this is a very good, very, very good evaluation diagnostic tool for looking at cardiac function. They can actually measure how well the heart's pushing blood out of the ventricles. Exercise treadmill tests. It can record symptoms and shows stress to the electrical pathways of the heart. That is the gold standard for diagnosing coronary artery disease prior to the more invasive angiogram. So, and then the American Society of Exercise suggests that you should have your first stress test at 50 and have one, if you're asymptomatic, I think the recommendation was every 5 years. We don't do that in Canada, unfortunately. It's a very easy test to do, and it works well. What'd you do? When did you do that? Oh, no. This is what I spent 10 years doing were these. Now, that's one thing that they are doing now as well is when I worked in the hospital, we would do an exercise treadmill test, and then the doctor would make a diagnosis based on the results and then move from there. Quite often now, and they're doing this in Barrie quite often, is you do your exercise treadmill test, and while your heart rate's still up, they throw you right on the table and do an echocardiography right then and there while you're still beating hard. A pain. Leads are flying all over the place. And yeah. Modifications of risk factors. So cessation of tobacco smoking, management of diabetes and hypertension, body weight reduction, lipid management, preventing excessive blood clotting, and annual influenza vaccinations will help with risk factors. Reducing fat intake can result in regression and disappearance of fatty streaks. These fatty streaks represent lipid-laden macrophages. Diet changes are recommended in everyone, including children and adults. So blood vessel changes related to heart disease begin as early as 15 years of age. So when we look at how families consume food, obviously bologna every night and high-processed foods, high-fat foods are not the way to go. Exercise and physical activity, recommended that aerobic endurance training for at least 3 days a week for at least 150 to 300 minutes a week at moderate intensity or 75 to 150 minutes a week of vigorous intensity or a combination of both will reduce risk. And resistance exercise involving large muscle groups at least 2 days per week at a moderate intensity level help prevent heart disease as well. So eating well, stop smoking, moderate alcohol, exercise. We can change all those things, all of them. In terms, I have a question for you. In terms of belief systems, so I think in India and Hinduism and vegetarianism, is there a reduction in heart disease in that demographic?
Yes.
Yeah. Yes.
Back in the time, mom used to tell me that
Yeah. It's the same as when I used to do exercise stuff. Trying to get people to understand they don't have to train for the Olympics, because look at farmers. What do they do every day? And in India, nobody has a car. Everybody walks to work and back home. On the field, working in the field. They live long, long time. Very long time. So it doesn't have to be going to the gym and pounding out on a treadmill. It just has to be go for a walk every day, keep active, do other things, right? Work around the house. Surgery, surgical treatments. PCI, also known as an angioplasty with a stent. So this is a percutaneous coronary intervention. A balloon stent is inserted through the artery, usually up through the femoral artery in the leg, and at the occlusion, it's inflated, which compresses the plaque, and quite often a stent is placed in the area. So what they'll do is, if this is a coronary artery, they'll come up through the femoral artery, and they will put a device in that kind of looks a bit like this. And this will balloon, and this will, they'll pump it up, and this thing will get so large, it'll get, just make it here, it'll get so large in a balloon, it will start to push the plaque up against the edges in terms of widening the diameter of the vessel. And quite often now, within this, I don't know, is it the same thing or is it two different tools? Do they do the balloon first, take it out, and then put the stent in? Or do they expand, do they actually expand the stent now? And the stent there? Okay. So think of that, they put the balloon in and they increase the diameter, and then they put a straw in, if you want to use that term. So they that when they, so that when they finish this procedure, what's left is that. So it opens up the diameter and allows blood cells to travel through unimpeded. In fact, it works so well. When I worked in the hospital, I worked in three different levels of acute coronary crisis. First was, if you had a heart attack, they would just try to support you and didn't have a whole lot to do. Then they went to clot busters, so they would give you a shot of, I can't remember the name of the drug. Sorry? Yes, streptokinase. And they would inject that in and it would eat the clot. It would dissolve the clot, thus opening up the passageway and have blood supply through. But it had lots of risks. Kidneys, what's that? It has to do in 6 hours. And when I was doing ECGs, if you got streptokinase, I had to do these very specific ECGs at certain times throughout the whole course of the therapy, throughout the day into the ICU. But if you had any kind of inflammation, I remember the first time it shocked me. I didn't know what was going on. I went into the ICU to do an ECG, and the gentleman smiled at me, and his entire mouth was full of blood because he had gingivitis. So he wasn't clotting. So his gums were actually just bleeding because of the streptokinase. And then my understanding also, in some people, it can really do damage to the kidney, right? I guess it can do damage to the kidney. So we went to streptokinase. Now, if you're having a heart attack, what is called a STEMI, so an ST elevated type of myocardial infarction, and you're in Orillia, you go into the ambulance, and the ambulance goes right here to Barrie. Now, it never used to have cardiac intervention here. You'd have to go in an ambulance all the way down to South Lake in Newmarket, and they would do this immediately and open up that occlusion through a balloon and stent, and then you're fine. Yes. Oh, yeah. And the stents now have changed unbelievably. I have a gentleman that is a friend of mine. Used to go to the gym with him quite often. He unfortunately had a large MI and they did the stent. He was feeling like $1 million, and in the middle of the night, the stent integrity broke and it collapsed and he had an occlusion. They saved his life, but he now has congestive heart failure because it ended up damaging a. significant amount of his left ventricle. Yeah. He had to do a bypass. He had to go in and redo, open him up and do a bypass. So, which is this, a coronary artery bypass graft. So an angiogram is performed to determine if there's a high grade of blockage in one or more arteries. And then what they do is they take a vein or an artery from somewhere else in the arm, leg, or chest, usually the internal mammary, radial, or brachial arteries, and they graft the vessel from either side of the block, so a retro and antegrade, and they do a complete bypass of the vessel, which allows the blood to pass through. So we can see here what's so important about dealing with this. Remember that the heart only utilizes oxygen for its metabolic requirements, basically, and that it never ever repairs itself with the muscle cells. It repairs itself with a fibrous scar. So no matter whatever happens to the heart, if heart tissue dies, it's always replaced with fibrous tissue, never with heart tissue, which means that that area never contracts like the rest of the heart ever again. So you can see here is the thrombus that's broken off the blood supply, and all of this white is dying myocardium. If we can't get blood supply to this, it will infarct, and then you will get this white scar-like tissue here, and that area of the heart will never contract again, and of course then it affects the ability of the heart to have a good ejection fraction and cardiac output. So here you can see the catheter goes in, the balloon inflates to push the plaque back, and then the stent is placed inside. I like this picture much better. You can see that the stent is overlies the balloon. So when the balloon is inflated, the stent's there, and then they just remove the balloon and the stent remains. So you can see here is the stent going through the partially occluded vessel with the plaque, and then by the time they've done the expansion and removed the balloon and left the stent, you can see that it's filled in pretty well here, and you have a good diameter to allow blood through to work properly. And then bypass here, we can see it here that we look under the fat here, we can see the vessels that lie deep to the pericardium here, but you can see these two vessels here that are stitched in. They're bypassing an area where a blood vessel is no longer supplying the heart, and that's what this outer vessel is here. It's traveling, and from this case, proximally, all the way around to wherever the other part of the heart is that it's covering. So you can see it here that they've bypassed here on the ascending aorta here, and then it's being placed into the area where the problem is, where the artery's been plugged. Okay. Pharmacotherapy. This type of management aims to reduce the risk of clotting, treat hypertension, reverse hyperlipidemia, and reduce inflammation. So these are drugs you need to know, and I will ask questions on them, because these are drugs you're going to come across in practice. We used to call it the Holy Trinity. So every patient after a heart attack got a beta blocker, they got a statin, and they got a lipid-lowering medication. Every single patient, I think it still happens, no matter what. You always get it. Beta blocker, lipid lower, and statin. Okay? So you're going to see them a lot in practice when you ask for your medications. That's why they're up here. So statins, they affect the key enzyme that lowers LDL levels, also reduces cardiovascular events. Now, the ones that are still in the book are Crestor, Lipitor, and Livalo. Do you have any other ones? Is there any new ones? Okay. So you're going to come across these. Quite often when you see OR, that's usually a statin. So that's one thing to keep an eye on, because medications do change, but they do try to keep similar names so that you have a sense of what they are. So that's your first drug that you're likely going to see is a statin. The next one is a beta blocker. Beta blockers block the effects of a hormone called epinephrine. And this causes the heart to beat slower and with less force. So this is what we want. By lowering the force and slowing the heart, the demand for oxygen goes down, okay? And so there's less demand on the vessels. Now, they'll put patients on beta blockers before there's even a cardiac event. If they think there's a bit of angina going on, for example, the patient will be put on a beta blocker to take a lot of stress off the heart. And again, the key thing to remember with beta blockers is the name always ends with a lol. Okay? So see, you've got isobutylol, atenolol, misoprolol, and metoprolol. Now, when I was in the hospital, when I just left, metoprolol was the big beta blocker. It still is still? Yeah. Yeah, still number one. Okay. So you're going to see those drugs quite often in practice. But the thing is with beta blockers, they have anybody's on beta blocker hates them because you feel like crap because it lowers your heart rate so much. My friend of mine just had remind me, I'll show you. He showed me the picture of his angiogram. You'll wonder how he was ever alive. But he's on beta blockers, and he was an athlete. So, of course, he's already got a lower resting heart rate. And usually athletes tend to really have a hard time with beta blockers because the heart rate gets so low, it's they got headaches, nausea, yeah, all that kind of stuff. So side effects of beta blockers are bradycardia, dizziness, fatigue, headache, erectile dysfunction, heart failure, and arrhythmias. I always laugh about erectile dysfunction because the whole reason for Cialis and Viagra was because so many North Americans were on beta blockers and so many men couldn't perform, they came up with a drug to help men. If women had a problem like this, I don't think they would have developed anything, which doesn't speak well of our society, but that's the reality of it. That's why they came. Although Viagra actually was a blood pressure medication that they attempted to use, men were coming in saying, I got a problem when I take the drug. I seem to have an erection all the time. Same as, what was the drug used to be? It was a hypertensive drug and it grew hair. And they use it. Yes, so they use it for growing hair in the head. It wasn't a great blood pressure med, but at lower levels, it actually grows hair. angiotensin converting enzymes, ACE inhibitors. So these help relax the veins and arteries to lower blood pressure. ACE inhibitors prevent an enzyme in the body from producing angiotensin II, which narrows blood vessels. So common ones here are Acupril, Altase, and Vasotec. In my mind, the most popular one was Altase, and then second was Vasotec. Still kind of the same, would you say? Yeah. The thing with these, though, a dry and persistent cough, and I'm talking a cough. When they get it, it's usually have to go off it because it tends to be so bad that they struggle with it. Fatigue, headaches, and dizziness. Antiarrhythmics. So after a heart attack, depending on the area of the myocardium that was affected, the electric pathways of the heart can also be affected, such as the SA node and the AV node and so forth. So patients can have associated arrhythmias after an MI. So sometimes they have to be dealt with. Not quite as common. Prevents arrhythmias, which lead to serious complications. So Lanoxin is kind of a popular one. Chest pain, diarrhea, headache, and hypotension can be a result of those. Calcium channel blockers. They were traditionally an hypertensive, but is indicated in angina and arrhythmias. It prevents the calcium from entering the cells of the heart and vessels. That was new to me. I had no idea. I thought it was still a hypertensive drug as a second defense, right? First is diet, and then calcium, and then beta. Well, right, diuretics, right, yes.
And then calcium channel blockers.
And then it occurs, and then okay. So back in the day, it was Cardizem was the big one, and then Adalat after that came, and then Norvasc, and now Tyvaso I'm not familiar with. I don't know if that's more American than Canadian. I don't know that one. Side effects, bradycardia, palpitations, peripheral edema, nausea, and GI reflex. Here's why it's important to know those. Because of the side effects as well, right? I had a big lesson learned. I think I told you guys about statins, right, with my patient with bilateral shoulder pain. And I was treating him for what I thought was like a supraspinatus tendonitis or something. But what was really weird, he initially came to me with left shoulder pain. I treated him for a couple of weeks. He came back again. I said, how's your left shoulder pain? It's gone. But now my right shoulder's killing me. And I'm like, okay. So I treated his right shoulder and went back to his left. I was driving home from Toronto. It was late at night. I was listening to CBC, and they had a medical specialist on there. And he was talking about how they always thought that statins didn't have side effects, but they were discovering musculoskeletal pain on with the use of statins. I called the next day, and I said, are you on a statin? He's like, yeah. I said, go to the doctor. And sure enough, the doctor had to take him off the statins because he was getting musculoskeletal, he was getting myalgias from the statin. So that's why you have to know all this stuff and start understanding the possibility that maybe the reason the patient's coming to you isn't because they have a musculoskeletal problem, but because they got a side effect of a medication, right? Anticoagulants used to prevent clotting, Coumadin, Eliquis, heparin, and Xarelto. I don't know that one. So Coumadin's pretty popular. Heparin, you don't see much anymore, I don't think, for anticoagulants. And even Coumadin's not that much. Yeah, my dad's on it. You don't have to do INRs or anything, right? So what happens is when you're on Coumadin, the patient has to go fairly frequently for blood work to see what their clotting times are. So they have to, because my understanding is the variation is very narrow. Doesn't have to be too much to suddenly. Yeah, okay. Oh, okay. Right. So this is the problem with it. Now, these new drugs, they don't have to do that anymore. It seems to be maintained. I have a cute little story. So I used to do phlebotomy in the hospital at 7 a.m. Phlebotomy is putting the needle in and filling the tubes with blood for the lab, right? So I had a lady, and she was elderly, and I had to do my paperwork, what's your name, your birth date, and then the tests are the particular color of the tubes that you have to use. There's blue and purple and kind of red, rusty color and whatever. So I get them all together, and I go into the anticubital vein. I take my tubes, right? I've opened the tourniquet, and I take the needle out, and I put the cotton batten in, and I tape it down. And I had this thing I'd always tell patients, for 5 minutes, don't bend your arm, because quite often when you bend the arm, the pressure of the cotton ball doesn't work as well. So okay, she's standing there, and I turn my back to her, and I'm putting my tubes in the right trays, and I'm clicking the boxes to make sure everything's all set to go to the next patient. And I turn her, I hear she says, I have a bit of a problem. And I said, oh. And I turned around, and it was like her whole forearm had been put in a can of red paint. And she'd pulled it out. It was covered. She was bleeding and dripping. I guess her INR had to be through the roof, right? I was like, oh my goodness, right? So I got, pressure. We finally got it stopped, but her INR had to be ridiculous. Just from a little needle poke. Crazy. Antiplatelets used to prevent clotting, so that's Plavix. Abdominal discomfort, headache, and backache. Diuretics. What do diuretics do? Diuretics make you pee. Gets rid of body fluid, therefore you have less volume. And it's easier on the heart. Because remember, the heart also has to pump water around as well as blood for the kidneys to deal with it, for you to urinate it out. So people on diuretics urinate a lot. Have you heard the term pissing like a racehorse? Okay, do you know why? Because in horse racing, they used to use Lasix to get the horse's weight down so they'd run faster. So they could always tell, the vets could tell if a horse was being treated that way, because the horse would be urinating and urinating and urinating and urinating to get the weight down before the race. So diuretics, as Sunil was saying, is one of the first lines of defense for hypertension. And so Alactone, Lasix, and Metamor, I don't know. Lasix is always the most popular one, still probably is, yeah. The thing with Lasix, though, is, I don't think I have it on here, there is no potassium levels are diminished with the amount of urine loss. So always recommend that a patient eat a banana a day when they're taking a diuretic, because they're starting to lose some what's the word I want? Not just potassium, but electrolytes. So this, what's that? Okay. Vasodilators are another one. Obviously, the more the greater the diameter of vessel, the less resistance, easier on the heart to move blood around. So vasodilators are used in angina pectoris. The common one is nitroglycerin, and that can be given a whole number of ways, under the tongue sprays, patches that are time released through the skin, for example. I worked with dynamite as a 19-year-old many years ago, and I had to cut, we got these packages of nitroglycerin, and we had to cut them in half and run the cordite through them. And no one told me to wear gloves. So I was working all day. You had to use a brass knife so there's no spark, right? So I'm cutting these packages of nitro, and about 4 hours in, my head felt like it was this big. I couldn't even see. And the boss came and goes, "Why aren't you wearing gloves?" And I'm like, "Nobody told me to wear gloves." Because you just absorb the nitro and it's a vasodilator. Oh my goodness. I had the worst headache for about 4 hours. I had to lay down and just go to sleep. A terrible headache. Cardiac rehabilitation is new, old but new. It's a controlled form of exercise that increases exercise tolerance without cardiac complications. Pretty much everybody who has a heart attack gets cardiac rehab now. So they go in, they're monitored, they wear a device to watch their heart rate, they walk on treadmills, they ride bicycles, they do exercise to again try to get tolerance up so they're able to go out and function fairly normally in the normal world. It's now considered integral in the management and treatment of CAD. Also includes a lifestyle education component that deals with diet, weight loss, smoking cessation, all those sorts of things. So, what's the prognosis? Comprehensive risk factor interventions in those with cardiovascular disease extend overall survival, improve quality of life, decrease the need for interventional procedures, and reduce the incidence of subsequent MI. Prognosis depends on the site of the damage of the myocardium and the extent of death or necrosis of the tissue. Fatality rates remain low before 35 years, and this incrementally increases with age until 75. Men generally experience mortality at twice the rate of women until 65 years, which is when the effects of estrogen are pretty much done. The female is postmenopausal, so the risk factors become pretty equal. Total coronary artery disease mortality in women after 65 now exceeds that of men. And I don't think that's all just hormonal. I think that's because medicine didn't understand the differences in heart disease when compared genders, and they would misunderstand a female who came into the off into the emergency department, didn't express like a male in terms of her symptomology, and they would misdiagnose her. Angina pectoris. So as atherosclerosis progresses, blood supply to the heart becomes more and more obstructive, which makes sense, right? It's narrowing the vessel. Results in a reduction of the amount of O2 the myocardium can receive, and therefore it starts lacking. When cardiac workload exceeds oxygen supply, you get ischemia, meaning lack of oxygen. Ischemia hurts. Whether it's ischemia in skeletal muscle or ischemia in heart muscle or ischemia to organs such as the mesenteric artery supplies, it's very painful. It can feel like squeezing or pressure. Angina is not a disease, but a presentation typical of underlying coronary artery disease that can progress to a heart attack. In fact, a couple times I've seen patients who have somewhat uncontrollable angina. And the medicine, the doctors have actually said, "I wish you'd just have a heart attack, then we can deal with it better than this," right? I have had a patient with Prinz metal. Yep, we couldn't figure out for the longest time what was going on with him. It's pretty neat. There are several types of anginal pain. There is stable angina. This is angina that occurs at predictable levels of exertion, and this tends to resolve just by lying down or stopping or nitroglycerin. You have unstable or pre-infarction angina. You get a huge changes in the intensity and frequency of symptoms and decreased threshold of stimulus. So, in other words, what I'm saying is the pain is quite uncomfortable, and over time, it takes less and less and less to get to that painful point, right? We had a very interesting, we had a gentleman one time doing a stress test. He had complained of shortness of breath and chest pain when he was out deer hunting. And we put him on the treadmill. Now it's called Bruce protocol. It's a very specific protocol of elevation and speed, and the patient almost gets to running, but we're incrementally making it harder and harder and harder. Did the full Bruce, stopped it. Doctor said, not seeing anything, I think you're okay. The patient just happened to say, yeah, but when I was working way harder than what you gave me when I had the problem. So the doctor said, okay, Brian, crank up the machine, let's get him on. And we got him beyond Bruce and really got him working. ST depressions, shortness of breath and pain, stopped it. So we got him really early, which would have saved his life, and off he went for probably an angiogram and all those sorts of things. So again, it depends on where they're at. He was probably a man who was probably in fairly good shape, and he needed a little more to get it to go. New onset angina, angina that's developed for the first time within the last 2 weeks, nocturnal angina, may awaken a person from sleep due to an increased heart rate. I was always told nocturnal angina means you're pretty advanced in your angina. That really needs to be kept an eye on. Post-infarction angina. These are folks who have an MI when residual ischemia results. When people have, this is very quite unfortunate because not a whole lot we can do with it. These are folks who have been medically treated, maybe even had a bypass or stent, and they still have a bit of angina, and unfortunately that's kind of something they have to live with. Prinzmetal vasospastic angio produces symptoms similar to typical angina. It's caused by abnormal or involuntary coronary spasms which squeeze the artery shut. It has to do, I believe it's calcium, correct? I think it's a calcium problem. So what happens is the individual can be sitting there and the coronary artery will spasm shut. We'll do an ECG and go, holy cow, he's having a heart attack, because it looks just like a heart attack. And you'll turn to the physician and they'll say, I don't have any pain anymore. And you go, what? So the physician will say, please do another 12 lead. And it's a perfectly normal ECG. So 1 minute it looked like the heart was really ischemic, and the next minute it looked fine. Don't come across it very often, but it does happen. Any condition that alters the blood supply to the heart can cause ischemia. Increased O2 needs of the heart, increased cardiac output, or reduced blood flow can cause angina. And, of course, the first sign of angina can be the result of physical exertion or any kind of event that increases the need for the heart to increase rate, contraction. In other words, anything that causes the heart to require more oxygen is basically what's at fault here. But remember, angina is not the disease. It's just a result of the progressing disease that can lead to a cardiac event. Angina is a symptom of ischemia, and the causes are exactly the same as atherosclerosis. So formation of the plaque, all those sorts of things, which again diminishes the diameter of the vessel, which decreases blood flow to the particular myocardium. So it's characterized by temporary pain or discomfort that starts suddenly in the chest and occasionally can radiate to the left shoulder and down the ulnar border of the arm to the fingers. It can also go up into the jaw on the same side as the pain. Okay? Ask Andrea about this. Why does heart pain, heart problem, cause arm pain? It has to do with the development of the nervous system inside mom. Okay? But ask her to draw it out for you when you have neural class. This is why we have referred patterns in organs, because organs don't have direct pain pattern, pain supply, so they use other patterns, other nerves to represent pain. But have her to kind of show it to you. Pain can also be referred to any dermatome from C3 to T4, back of the neck, lower jaw, teeth, upper back, interscapular area, and abdomen. And probably like you, I've seen them all at some point with different people. Varies between individuals and gender. Can also be described as squeezing, burning, pressing, heartburn, indigestion, or choking. I had one guy like literally make himself burp the entire time trying to say, no, it's just heartburn. Usually expressed as mild or moderate, 1 to 3 minutes, but can persist. That should be 1 to 3 minutes, but can persist for 15 to 20 minutes. Women with abdominal symptoms sometimes can be relieved by antacids, but it just doesn't go away, and they end up showing up and emerge anyways. In women, the symptoms are atypical, less reliable, don't follow these classic patterns we mentioned above. But with women, a lot more breathlessness, pain in the left chest, upper abdominal pain and back or arm pain, and one thing the book didn't talk about, but I know this from experience, nausea and vomiting. Females will tend to have nausea and vomiting, where the men not so much. Okay. Described as sharp or fleeting as well. Diagnosis, strongly suspected if history is present, and is supported if sublingual nitro shortens an attack and if prophylactic nitrates allow for greater exertion. So sometimes the physician doesn't know in an acute situation in the emergency department, so they'll just say, oh, I'll give you a little spray of nitro under the tongue, and they'll say, oh, I feel so much better. Then you know what you're dealing with. Resting ECG is normal, and the stress test can also support the diagnosis. How do we prevent it? Obviously, to treat it, we want to prevent them in the first place, exactly the same as we would in the prevention of coronary artery disease. Quit smoking, weight loss, activity levels, and so forth. Treatment of other underlying pathologies is essential. Avoid situations of exertion that precipitate the angina. Sublingual nitro is the drug of choice for acute attacks, meaning it's a spray that goes under the tongue into the mucous membrane. Other medications can include beta blockers and calcium channel blockers. Revascularization procedures are recommended for those who do not become ischemic free on medical therapy. So sometimes they may have to go in and do further, like a bypass or something. Prognosis, it leaves the heart vulnerable to arrhythmias and an MI, which can be fatal. So usually when someone has angina, they're being medically managed much more often than the average person. They're being checked on all the time. Okay? You guys want to take a break? See you at 10 to? Yes? Okay. Take a break. And away we go. Okay, hypertension. You've heard the term. You measure it, you do blood pressures, and this is going to help understand and highlight for you. You came just in time.
Lovely.
So, you've all heard the term hypertension, yes? Okay. So hypertension is? Right. So, includes hypertensive vascular disease and hypertensive heart disease. So you can damage vessels, and you can damage heart with chronic long-term hypertension. Blood pressure, of course, is the force exerted against the walls of the arteries and arterioles. Diastolic pressure, normal, is 80 millimeters of mercury. So that equals the pressure that's in vessels when the heart is relaxed. Systolic pressure, normally around 120 millimeters of mercury, is the pressure exerted on the arteries when the heart contracts. Between 55 and 60 years of age, diastolic pressure often begins to plateau and may even drop, whereas systolic often starts to rise. Why? After everything we just talked about, there's your hint. Not thinner, stiffer. So they don't have the ability to, they're not as pliable, they're stiffer. So this is why this happens. It presents a serious threat to the health of the client's heart. Consistent, elevated peripheral pressure puts added stress on vascular walls as well as the myocardium itself. This is what people need to recognize when they have hypertension. It is asymptomatic the majority of the time. If blood pressure causes symptoms, it means the blood pressure is critically high and it's dangerous. So this is why hypertension is called the silent killer, because it has no symptomology whatsoever. The patient doesn't even know they have high blood pressure until someone like you in clinic takes their blood pressure a few times, and it's really, really high, but the patient still probably doesn't even know it. The other thing to always remember about hypertension, you will ask a patient, do you have high blood pressure? They will say, no, I don't. I take pills. Because their blood pressure, the pills take their blood pressure back to normal, they quite often think they don't have hypertension. But the fact they have to take meds to get their blood pressure normal, they do have hypertension. They always have to recognize that. Blood pressure between 120 and 129 systolic and less than 80 diastolic is considered to be elevated, but not of concern to be doing any treatment or anything. Hypertension stage 1 is labeled as values of systolic pressure between 130 and 139, or diastolic between 80 and 89. Systolic levels at least 140 or diastolic levels of at least 90 are categorized as hypertension stage 2. And then hypertension above that, of course, is, you know, they start to get into still stage 2, but it's considerably more serious. So hypertension can be classified according to the type, systolic or diastolic, the cause, and the degree of the severity. So this is the way we look at it. For our purposes, right, we're only looking at what a patient may come to you with, what the physician told them. But for us, of course, we're concerned with things above 135 or so to whatever. But here's the thing. If the patient walks in today and you take their blood pressure and it's 140 over 90, do they have hypertension? No. Because you've only taken, and if it's not in their history, I should preface that. If they don't have any history of hypertension, you take it, it's 140 over 90. Do you make a diagnosis, not that we diagnose, but do you make a diagnosis of hypertension based on one reading? No, right? And this is where students sometimes get a bit panicky because, you know, the patient didn't say they had hypertension, but I just took their blood pressure today, it's 140 over 90. Should I do modifications, right? I would suggest they don't have hypertension yet. Obviously, it's not for us to diagnose in the first place. But secondly, one reading, because they could come in tomorrow and be 120 over 80. There may have been a reason why they ran in. I'm assuming you've been told that if it's 140 over 90, you should take it again, like what? What are you told, 10 or 15 minutes later type of thing? Is that what you've been told? Yeah. So this should be done again within 5 to 10 minutes once they've calmed down to come in. Because you don't know if they just had a huge fight with their partner or something very stressful in their private life or they ran in or whatever, right? So you should always take a second one within 5 to 10 minutes to make sure. What's the criteria? It has to be how many times do they have to present with these numbers over how many appointments, right? Before you start to say definitively. Okay, yeah, to yeah. These ones here, yeah. So, again, you're only taking a small little snapshot within their life, so you need to be considerate of it, right? You need to recognize that it's a bit high, but you don't have to panic over it, okay? Off the record, honestly, come on. What are we going to do? You're talking to a guy who worked in cardiology. We have someone with 160 over 100 and put them on the treadmill and make them run hard, right? A little of this, like, I don't know. I have a hard time with it. I kind of do. But that's the way it is. Yes. Yeah. I'm thinking I may give this to Ann or someone to put this in the clinic because this is what to go by, right? Less than this is low risk. This is moderate risk. But again, keeping in mind things, an elevated risk would be higher than this. But again, it's not crises. It's just an elevated risk of problems. Because the important thing with hypertension is not the one time it's high. It's the chronic period of time that they do have the hypertension that does the damage and concerns their health and so forth. So there's primary or essential hypertension, also known as idiopathic hypertension, and this accounts for 90 to 95%. What does idiopathic mean? Yeah, we don't know why it happened. We have absolutely no idea why they walk in with hypertension. And to this day, we still are never able to figure it out. Right? They just come in and they're suddenly presenting with hypertension. Then there's secondary hypertension, which accounts for 5 to 10% of the cases and results from an identifiable cause, which could be kidney disease as one example and so forth. So it gets to related to it. And again, that becomes part of the investigation with a physician as well, right? If it's suddenly high out of nowhere, they'll do a kidney thing and whatever, right? Or blood work for hormones and whatever. Labile hypertension is intermittent elevation interspersed with normal. And then there's something called malignant hypertension, used to be known as hypertensive crisis. This is a syndrome of markedly elevated blood pressure, systolic greater than 180 and or diastolic greater than 120. That is freaking high. Okay? With target organ damage, retinal hemorrhage, heart failure, renal insufficiency. I had a friend who had a mitral valve replacement done this summer. He had the non-invasive one where they go in through the chest wall here, deflate the lung, and do the replacement there rather than opening up the chest and so forth, right? So we had it done. It was going really, really well. They sent him back to his bed, and he texted us and said, "I think the doctor says it went well. Everything's great." And then that night, the nurse came running in. He was going into ventricular tachycardias. And they're like, "What's going on?" And so they started dealing with it. They got to calm down. And then from there, he emailed me from the hospital. He goes, "No, he got home." So they got that all straightened out. And then he was going into atrial fib as well. And it was all just an irritated heart. I just didn't like the procedure. So he's at home. He's been home for a day. He goes, "Brian, I took my blood pressure. It's 220 over 150." And I said, "Did you go to the hospital?" He's like, "No." I'm like, "Errol, that's a medical crisis. I'm not saying your machine's right, but if it's saying that, you should have been to Emerge." So we took it again after I talked to him. I need to go to Emerge, and they were like, "Oh my God, right?" So it can spike on people. Worldwide, 31% of the adult population has hypertension. One in three Americans older than 20 has it, and two of every three adults older than 60 has high blood pressure. Two of three, which means, are you likely going to see this in practice? Oh yeah. Okay. Hypertension, except for smoking in men, is the highest risk factor for cardiovascular disease mortality. So there is no etiology to primary hypertension. It's probably genetics and smoking and so forth. It's estimated 75% of individuals with hypertension are obese. She's wolfing down her Sun Chips.
I
75%. I'm kidding you. I love those things, actually. Blood pressure is affected by many determinants, including vascular stiffness and endocrine and autonomic factors. So if we go back to atherosclerosis and stiffening vessels, increased resistance, you can see that they all play a role to some degree within each other. With the abundance of antihypertensive medications, less than 50% have it controlled. That's a big deal. Because people, in fact, I don't know what the criteria is exactly, but if a patient needs to be put on an antihypertensive, the standard for medications is not 120 over 80. I believe it's 130 over 85 or 90, right? If they can get it to that, that's. Yeah, I thought so. Yeah. Okay. So you have to look forward to. Arterioles regulate blood pressure. So in the realm of vessel size, how big are arterioles? They go right into the capillary, so they are the super tiny ones. They have the most effect on blood pressure of any vessel in the body. It's the small ones. There's miles upon miles upon miles of arterioles in the body. So if they have a problem, they're going to have a problem. So here's my call based on my comment earlier about massage. What does massage do to arterioles? Yeah, through hyperemia, right? So if arterioles control the majority of resistance and blood pressure, and massage causes vasodilation of arterioles when we apply techniques, how do we affect hypertension? In fact, you take post-treatment blood pressures after, they'll all be down. So why is it a risk? I don't understand why the profession sees it that way, but what do I know? Risk factors can be modifiable and non-modifiable. Of course, same as cardiovascular disease, right? Smoking, obesity, sedentary lifestyle, and so forth. Risk increases with age as arteries lose elasticity. Hypertension being affected with age, those whose hypertension started at a younger age have a poorer prognosis with outcomes because they have it longer, more damage. Hypertension is a significant risk factor for TAD, stroke, heart failure, and renal failure. What's an NSAID? Give me an example. What's an NSAID? You're probably taking one. You probably took one. You probably, yeah. Yeah. Are you taking Advil? Tylenol? What do you take for pain relief? Oh, naproxen. There you go. Okay. There you go. Okay. Interesting. Increases blood pressure even more. Okay. Alcohol increases risk of hypertension. And this statement goes back and forth all the time, doesn't it? Relationship between sodium and hypertension. One year will say, everybody's got to be off sodium. Next year, someone will have a bit of research and says there's no relationship between sodium and hypertension. So I don't know where to stand with it. So that's probably based on his physician. At the time, the physician probably told him to stay away with it, which is quite commonly said by physicians when a patient has hypertension and heart and frankly, heart disease too, right? But again, the correlation goes backwards and forwards with research all the time. So I think we go with the Ben Franklin theory. Do you know the Ben Franklin theory? Everything in moderation. Right? But the thing is, you may avoid using salt in your shaker at home. That's not where you get your salt from. This is where you get your salt from. Right? This is where it all comes from. And not just seeds in particular, but processed foods. Cold meats, chips. Yeah, I know what salt's in ham. So my grandfather had his first heart attack in, I think it was 1965. And the approach to heart disease was much different then. He was no longer allowed like Kraft cheese slices, cold meats. The salt shaker had to be right off the table entirely. My grandmother was one of those folks. She'd make a roast beef sandwich for his lunch and then take the salt shaker and just put it on top, right? Yeah. And he was a Newfie. So Newfies eat salt cod, like a lot of it, when he was growing up as a kid. So I still think there's a bit of a correlation, as I say, just everything in moderation. Just be careful with your sodium. But guess what happens as we get older? We lose our taste buds. And what do to enhance our food? Or soy sauce, right?
Oh, I love soy.
Well, there's another prime example of a good salt intake. Inadequate sleep is a risk factor. Now, here's something that's interesting. Sleep, lack of sleep, is a risk factor. So adults in their fourth to sixth decade who sleep less than 5 hours each night. And what's not in there is sleep apnea. There's a correlation between hypertension and sleep apnea. You know what sleep apnea is, right? Those that snore and stop breathing. So there's a correlation there because they get such a poor night's sleep. I mean, there's actually, and we don't really do sleep apnea. I don't know if we should include it in here because there's a lot of research coming out with a lot of diseases that are a result of sleep apnea. And those folks die more on the highway because they get up in the morning and they go to work and they have no focus because they don't sleep at night and they get in car accidents and lots of stuff with apnea. Blood pressure is regulated by two factors, blood flow and peripheral vascular resistance. Blood flow is determined by cardiac output, so when the ventricles beat, of course, that's how much they're putting out. And, of course, resistance is determined by the diameter of blood vessels. And we just previously said it's arterioles, the smallest ones that affect that, so they're dilation and constriction plays an important role in resistance. Increased peripheral resistance as a result of the narrowing of arterioles is the most common characteristic of hypertension. So if a, a minor-sized a myocardial artery is being occluded partially by these plaques, what do you think an arteriole looks like? Because it is immensely narrower than this. So this is what happens when people have, remember I said that they take arteries from other parts of the body, right, or veins? Some individuals, they'd like to use arteries if they can, because when they do bypass, the blood the pressures are there and the artery deals with it better. But unfortunately, if people have long-standing coronary artery disease, they probably have long-standing peripheral artery disease, and those arteries are useless to utilize, so they have to go to veins. So, same here, we have to think about. Prolonged pressure on the elastic tissues of the arterial wall is replaced by fibrous collagen fibers, which of course aren't as easy to get large and small, and therefore we end up with greater resistance. And of course, this results in less tissue perfusion, especially in the heart, kidneys, and brain. And because it's heart, kidneys, and brain, that's the thing, we always talk about hypertension in the heart, but also can affect the kidneys and also affect the brain as well. In terms of things like dementia, those sorts of things, right, can come up, and the kidney failure can be a result of longstanding hypertension as well. Atherosclerosis also accelerates the hypertensive environment. So frequently asymptomatic, right? That's what I said. It's common nickname is the silent killer, hypertension, because there is no symptomology most of the time. Well, the vast majority of the time. And when symptoms do occur, headache, occipital, present in the morning, worse on waking, and improved through the day. Vertigo, flush-faced. Now, do you guys know what epistaxis is? Nosebleed. So the blood pressure will get so high that the tiny, tiny vessels in the nose will actually burst because of the higher pressure, and they'll actually get nosebleeds. If your pressure is to the point where your vessels in your nose are bursting, you have to be really concerned about the little vessels in here, because if they burst, it is not so good. That's why it becomes kind of an emergency situation. Blurred vision and nocturnal urinary frequency. Sleep disorder breathing also associated with hypertension in the middle-aged and older individuals. So, of course, that's sleep apnea, right? Management. Everyone should know their blood pressure regardless of age. You should have an annual check as part of your annual physical. Most important prevention factor, of course, is physical activity and exercise. Getting the idea that we should be moving and grooving, right? The more exercise. Remove or modify the risk factors, of course, same as cardiovascular disease, weight control, smoking cessation, getting active, diet, and all those sorts of things. Treatment, it does require ongoing treatment. Goal is to achieve and maintain the lowest safe possible blood pressure. Getting below 130 over 80 is the kind of the goal. Management usually starts with modifying risk factors first, pharmacotherapy second. Common meds are ACE inhibitors, diuretics, beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, and vasodilators. So again, if 2 and 3 have hypertension in the clinical setting, you're going to see these meds. Right? You're going to see some of these meds that we talked about with heart disease as well. Only 30% of hypertension can be controlled with one drug, so usually they're on a combination. Hypertension is the leading cause of death in the world, and more than 50% who die from coronary artery disease had hypertension. So it's something that really has to be managed. It's very dangerous for us. When a person with hypertension achieves the target blood pressure, it must be emphasized that blood pressure control does not equal cure. That's right out of the book. That's not even my statement. So it's not, in my mind, it's never a bad idea to have a conversation with your patient in treatment. Oh, you have hypertension. Do you take your pills regularly? Why not? Right? You have to be controlled. It's better for you. It's like you with insulin, right? You probably have friends who are diabetic and they, yeah, I kind of do it and sometimes I forget, and right? That's not a good thing. You've got to, if you've got, you've got to accept that for yourself and maintain strategy towards dealing with it. So this is probably something Sunil's seen before. You don't necessarily need to know it, but the reason I'd like you to have a look at it is it represents the algorithm that a physician will use when a patient comes to them newly with hypertension or diagnosed early hypertension or stage 1 or stage 2. And this is what they will do, is how they'll start and work their way through in terms of decision-making as to what interventions the patient should get. And again, we don't have to know this per se, but get a sense of it as to what the approach is and why it is the way it is, okay? Myocardial infarction, another better known as a heart attack. I used to love it. They what would they call it? I'm having a coronary. What? Coronary? You're having a crown? That's a term we used to use all the time, right? This is a myocardial cell death as a result of ischemia. There are two major types. MI type 1 is caused by coronary artery disease. You get this plaque disruption. You get an associated thrombus and occludes the artery, and no blood gets to the myocardium, and then you've got a problem. The second type is due to a mismatch between O2 supply and myocardial demand. You don't have a plaque disruption, but you get to a point where the plaque is large enough and narrowing the vessel enough that you do get ischemic changes to the myocardium because not enough blood cells can get through that narrow opening. Over 800,000 MIs every year in the U.S. with 150,000 deaths. Does that number shock you? Oh, 8 million, sorry. You're right, I missed a comma. Hey, there's a lot of heart attacks. I pretty much say there were times when I worked in the hospital, we would have one a day for a month and a half. And we're getting into the worst time. Heavy, wet snow. We always called it cardiac snow. You get up in the morning, you got that slushy stuff. Yep, somebody's going to be coming in today. That heavy shovel, because it's anaerobic. It's hard upper body work, and then down they go. Actually, one of the fellows I work with here, he's a teacher in the nursing program. He was at home with his mom, and they were calling him for dinner, and he didn't come in, and they went out, and he had been shoveling snow, and he'd met his demise while shoveling snow, which is pretty common, actually. So when we look at myocardial infarctions, the risk factors are exactly the same as any coronary artery disease. Smoking, drinking, overweight, sedentary lifestyle, and so on and so forth. The majority result from a thrombus formation at the site of the atherosclerotic stenosis, and every fifth MI is silent. I have seen many patients who came in for a completely unrelated thing. They come in for surgery. Okay, they come in for surgery. And part of what we have to do for surgery, because of their age, we have to do blood work, sometimes a pulmonary function test, but always an ECG. And it was not unusual for the ECG to be done. The physician would come in, and we knew this, but the physician would come in and look at the ECG and go, oh, look at that. They've had a heart attack. Didn't know it. Had no idea they had it. But the ECG showed that there's tissue damage. So it's not unusual. Every fifth is silent. So we can see here that we get the blood clot. We get reduced or no flow of blood to the area. And then, therefore, the distal or the parts of the heart that vessel supplies lacks blood, and then you start into the whole process of this death of this muscle. So, again, coronary myocardium requires oxygen to create ATP in order for it to function. So, therefore, any kind of occlusion in a vessel that supplies the myocardium, you're into trouble because then the tissue absolutely needs the oxygen. One or more of these can become occluded by a clot with these arteries that forms from plaque ruptures. Most infarcts occur from an occlusive thrombus superimposed on an atherosclerotic plaque. So a thrombus, you've got the plaque, just like we went through here, and it gets so large, and then you get this thrombus, this clot that occludes or completely blocks that pathway, and blood doesn't get to where it's supposed to go. Plaque is more common than plaque erosion. Most common site is the left ventricle due to the occlusion of the left ascending. Okay, or left anterior descending, sorry. Occlusion of the left circumflex produces an anterior lateral or posterior lateral infarction. Right coronary artery leads to infarction of the posterior inferior portion of the heart, left ventricle, and some of the right ventricle. And the right coronary involvement may affect both the SA node and the AV node, which results in arrhythmias. So, It's just understanding what that vessel supplies will affect whatever part of the heart it does supply. That's kind of what that's getting at. So it's something to keep in mind. Then, you know, they might tell you what kind they've had, and just kind of give you a sense of it. Ischemia, of course, only takes a few minutes for it to start to affect. It really can do a number on it. It starts because it's O2 dependent, the myocardium, it actually ends up being suffering very, very quickly as a result of the loss of oxygen. So O2 deprivation results in electrolyte disturbances. So we have a cellular loss of potassium, calcium, and magnesium. When we lose these, we lose contractile properties. And when we lose contractile properties, the myocardium diminishes, and we have reduction of moving blood in and around. And remember, if you remember the way the heart works, that when we look at the blood ejection from the left ventricle, we have the two coronary arteries right at the base of the aorta that feed those arteries. And if we start to see diminishing of left ventricular function, then of course, then the myocardium is not going to go there. So we end up with this cycle where we get the occlusion to the muscle doesn't contract well, so we're limiting blood to the coronary artery, and it becomes a bit of a cycle. After 10 minutes of ischemia, myocyte necrosis begins. Leukocytes aid in the removal of the dead cells, and cardiac fibroblasts form a scar. Therefore, it doesn't contract. What's interesting is, what's been discovered here, and I don't really have it in here, but is when we get these cardiac myocytes, when they start to go, they also start apoptosis, and you get ensuing cell death even if we reperfuse the tissue. Right? That's what the best way to put it, eh? Yes. Right. Correct. Correct. And unfortunately, this is why people can get treatment and think they're doing well and then die on you. Sorry, I'm not trying to be rude. I'm looking for something here. I told you I was going to show you. So, when blood flow is restored, the myocardial reperfusion injury occurs, and this causes the tissue to produce massive amounts of reactive O2. Remember, reactive O2 is? Right, free radicals that damage the intracellular components. Oh, I can't find it here. Oh, I got to find it for you, Sunil, because you'll look at it and you'll wonder how the guy lived. It was nuts. He showed it to me, and I was like, dude, how are you still alive? Yeah. So what's it look like when you're having it? Sudden sensation of pressure, radiate often to the arms, throat, neck, and back, especially the left arm. Pain can last 30 minutes to hours and can be accompanied by pallor. There's a very distinct color. What happens in the body when you're having a heart attack is the heart is screaming to the body, I'm having trouble. The body will vasoconstrict peripheral arteries and drive all the blood inward to help the heart. It's not white. I can look at somebody and know they're having a heart problem. It's a different, we used to call it cardiac gray. It's a specific color that's related to this loss of peripheral blood. Everything starts to drive in and they get this color. Yeah. Yeah. And that's, if I see that, I'm like, we're getting an ambulance because something's, yeah, it's not nice. You won't know it. As soon as you see it though, once you see it, you know, you can look at it and go, oh, 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 right? Even before they say they're not feeling well, sometimes you witness it and you walk over, are you okay? And they go, yeah. And they're like, no, not so much. It's kind of a strange thing. So pain can last 30 minutes. And then, of course, you get this shortness of breath and profuse perspiration. This is known as diaphoresis. Two major symptoms for women are shortness of breath and unexplained fatigue. You can get uncommon symptoms that include stomach pain, heartburn, nausea, and or vomiting. Post-infarct complications, so after you've had the infarct, include arrhythmias, heart function, cardiogenic shock, and this is when your heart cannot pump enough blood and oxygen to the brain and other vital organs, and they start to shut down, right? Kidneys, liver, they all start to go. Pericarditis, rupture of the heart, thromboembolism, recurrent infarction, and sudden death. Medical management, of course, is the same as atherosclerosis prevention. So this is an ECG. We'll see how good Sunil is. What's that show you, Sunil? Where? So that represents? Yeah, in what area of the heart? Yeah. So likely LAD. Yeah. Yeah. So this is a heart attack. So the individual who's having the, this is my life. This was my life for 10 years to read these things, okay? And what you're seeing here in these areas, you see how this, we have a nickname for these. They're called tombstones because this is a significantly serious heart attack and this individual can die. That's why we call them tombstones. This is a medical emergency, right? This is showing significant loss of oxygen in the myocardium when you see these high. This should come down and be flat down here. So the line off of this piece here, this line here, should be down here. The fact that it's up there is telling you that that lead is taking a, think of it as a camera, it's taking a picture right through the chest wall at the heart. So in that area where this lead is looking into, that area of the heart has no oxygen, and hence the reason why. I won't explain why, it's much more complicated, but this is why, this is one of the biggest tests that hospitals do. It's non-invasive, it doesn't hurt, and gives so much information. And nurses don't take it in the curriculum.
You don't?
Nope. All they learn is the QRS, and that's it. I know, they have to take it after they graduate. Isn't that crazy? Yep. Yep. That's why I chose it, because it's a really good example of it, right? So this is showing specific areas of the heart that are not getting oxygen. So that's an MI. Now, obviously for us, what's important for us? What's important for us is A, risk factors. So if you have a patient you're treating and they have longstanding, somewhat uncontrolled hypertension, and they come to you one night for treatment and they're complaining of chest pain, you might want to consider that, yes. Right, so understanding the symptomology, understanding associated things that influence the probability of having something like an MI, is where you start to be more mindful of if a patient comes and says, oh, I've got some pain in my chest. That's when you're like, well, where if someone, you know, comes in who seems totally fine, right? Because I always use this example in with students, you've got chest pain, comes into your office. How are you going to determine, you need to go to the hospital because I'm concerned about this, or, yeah, I think you pulled your pec muscle. Because pectoralis major can refer up the neck and so forth. So this is why all this stuff's so important, because you may have to make a determination. Obviously, your determination is always conservative. It's better to send them to the hospital and have nothing than it is to not send them to the hospital and have them die on your table, which thankfully that's never happened to me. If it was, I'd grab them by the ankles and drag them out into the parking lot so that when the investigation happened, it happened out there. Okay. Heart failure. I've used the term a lot. This is something else you're going to see quite often. So, it is a complex clinical syndrome that results from any structural or functional impairment of ventricular filling for ejection of blood. In other words, the easy definition for heart failure is the left ventricle or the right ventricle's inability to squirt blood out into either the lungs on the right or the aorta on the left, right? So whatever happens to the heart that affects ventricular contraction, in other words, it's not pumping well, it's determined as heart failure. We used to call it congestive heart failure, but we don't anymore. It's just called heart failure. Failure typically develops and is predominantly affects one side of the heart, either right or left. Quite often it's a result of a heart attack, and it can be a chronic disease over many years, and it's pharmacologically managed. When I worked at the hospital way back when in 92 in cardiology, congestive heart failure was basically a death sentence. You would have it for a while, and unfortunately, we managed it somewhat, but you would end up dying from it. We now manage it very, very well, and patients live a very long period of time. We use four classes of heart failure, class 1 through 4. Class 1 is asymptomatic. Class 2 is mild. Class 3 is moderate. And class 4 is severe. So class 1 really doesn't show symptoms. Class 2 shows symptoms when you're performing activity. Class 3, you got to do a little more activity to feel the effects. And then step 4 is you're affected whether you're doing nothing or doing something. I can leave it at that. So, you guys have a midterm coming up. No? Yeah, in 2 weeks, yes. 2 weeks, right. Yeah.